Welcome in to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Land shelves and land masses. We talk about what we know for current history and biblical history. Let's talk about undersea kingdoms, kingdoms we know, and kingdoms we think existed and we actually know existed. We're going to merge all this today. I know I'm playing word salad with you here, but I want to talk about one kingdom in particular that doesn't get as much attention as maybe, say, Atlantis. I'm going to talk about Lemuria today with our guest, Justin McHenry. Lemuria. When I say Lemuria or Lemuria, we talk about lemurs, right? We know what lemurs are. But do we know anything about Lemuria, or what do we know about Lemuria? We talk about land shelves and how lemurs got to our modern day country, or how they moved or migrated. We got to talk about a land shelf, right? They didn't just swim everywhere. Things don't just swim everywhere. And we'll talk about that with Justin. There's different theories and different scientists who came into it. We'll talk about that with Justin as well. What I find fascinating is how we choose to deny certain things about history or what we consider fact or scientific fact for diatribes of religion, or what we consider dogma, or what we look at in a book that's thousands of years old, and we choose to deny what's sitting in front of us as far as scientific theory goes. Justin's put out a remarkable book. It's jam-packed full of different scientific facts that have been accumulated throughout the ages. It's called Lemuria, A True Story of a Fake Place. And it documents a lot of this history and a lot of these scientific facts. And I think you'll find it very, very interesting. I'm going to bring him in now. First, let's tell you a little bit about Justin. Justin himself is very interesting. He's a writer and historian who loves to find the little nooks and crannies in histories and the stories that live there. He brings them out right out in the open. He's done that with this new book. His work has appeared in Belt Magazine, 100 Days in Appalachia, Journal of the American Revolution, Fate Magazine. He's also appeared in several historical journals. His stories have been syndicated in newspapers and have appeared in annual collections. And boy, I'll tell you, when you read this book, it is a smart book. It hits you with not just facts, but it's very entertaining as well. So first of all, I want to tip my cap as I bring in to Darkness Radio, Justin McHenry. Justin, how you doing?
Doing well. Thank you so much, Tim, for having me. I appreciate you bringing me on. And so we can talk a little bit about Lemuria and have a good time doing it.
Forgive me if I'm butchering the name. I've heard it Lemuria. Is it? How do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Lemuria, if I think about it. Lemuria.
Lemuria.
Yeah, not Lemuria.
Right, it wouldn't be Lemuria. Right.
Yeah.
So. Because the animals didn't run the kingdom, so to speak, right? At least as far as we know.
Yeah. Only in certain ones. Only in, like, really in the New Age era did they bring about, like, these lemur-like creatures who were on the earth and were, you know, seeding crystals for, you know, extraterrestrials for their spaceships, fuel for their spaceships.
Boy, jumped right into it, didn't you?
I did, man. Yeah, I just right straight for the crazy right off the bat, so
just,
don't worry.
Just both feet. You just didn't hold back there. I love it. Mm-hmm. we'll get to that in a little bit. I was going to build, but hey, why not?
it's a little appetizer for people.
I like that.
To get them interested and see where Lemuria goes to.
That's right. Boy, that's a hell of a teaser, too. We'll get to that a little bit later. I wanted to start a little slower here, because as we know, we can't exactly take a plane to this place anymore. It's not like there's a destination. You can't just go to Delta, book a ticket and go. But tell us whereabouts this kingdom supposedly is sitting.
Okay. It is right smack dab in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So kind of what Atlantis is to the Atlantic Ocean, Lemuria is to the Pacific Ocean. And actually, it almost started in the Indian Ocean, too. And so it kind of migrates itself. The continent migrates itself across the Indian Ocean into the Pacific Ocean. But most people who believe in Lemuria or believed in Lemuria had it right there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Okay.
And it was a huge continent, too. It was almost like the entire size of the Pacific, ranging for the Theosophist, it was almost butting up against the west coast of America.
Really?
Yeah.
So that begs the question. So if it's butting up almost against the west coast of America, are there indigenous peoples that are there? And are there people that are migrating off our shelf of what we consider North America onto there? I suppose, am I jumping ahead here? Or?
A little bit, because, Tim, you make an interesting point, because that is the whole idea around Lemurians within Mount Shasta in California.
Okay.
And how they got there was the west coast of America was the east coast of Lemuria. And so when Lemuria sank, Some Lemurians went and dug a hole in, or dug a tunnel or a cave or whatever inside of Mount Shasta and lived there. And they had, wild parties and were doing a bunch of fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll rewind a little bit.
We're getting another little teaser.
Yeah, a little teaser there, a little nugget for people to kind of chew on here, where we start from the beginning of the book. You start to talk about lemurs themselves.
Yeah.
And the actual animal, which are fascinating animals, because it's not your typical monkey, ape, whatever it is. Give us a little background on lemurs, what they are, their existence, and why they're such a fascinating animal.
Yeah, so lemurs are really fed. There's many different types of species of lemurs, many different varieties of them. But I think one of the most interesting things is they all appear on Madagascar. You can't find a lemur unless they've been captured and held in captivity in a zoo or something along those lines. But occurring naturally, they only appear on Madagascar. And so that's kind of how the whole story begins, is people, zoologists in the 19th century were trying to figure out how did these, species arrive onto Madagascar. And also, that goes for all of these species on Madagascar, just because it's a large island off the coast of Africa. And so there was much thought into, how did lemur-like species, because you find lemur-like species in South America, you find them in Africa, you find them in India, and elsewhere in like Southeast Asia as well. And so they're trying to figure out, how did that migration happen, or what was that migration look like? And so in that process, they came up with the idea of a land bridge that kind of connected all of these places, and that would have accounted for lemurs getting onto Madagascar, but also their ancestors, spreading out from all the different other points of the world.
Which would make sense. I mean, we've talked in the past about land bridges, and you talk about, when we talk about, from Europe, and you talk about specifically when we talk Russia, Alaska, you talk about land bridges, or you talk about how different I'm trying to find the words here, Justin. Words is hard today. How different species of people got to different... I don't want to say species of people. That sounds horrible, Justin. Jeez, listen to me, Mr. White Power over here. How different people or different races of people got to different areas, or how different people settled in different areas. Mm-hmm. One of the ones that fascinates me, and I know we're going to get off on a tangent here somewhere. I don't know if you've ever heard Timothy Hogan speak about, there's an island in Egypt where the Egyptian government has closed it off because they don't want you to see the hieroglyph of an Aztec handing something to an Egyptian. I'm trying to remember what it is, what the exact... I'm trying to remember the name of the island. Again, I'm woefully My memory is Swiss cheese today. But they're saying, how exactly would you, would you accomplish this, that an Aztec would meet an Egyptian, other than some sort of Stargate or travel or whatnot. But you talk about land shelves, and we talk about how, the Earth probably looked different in those times. And land shelves are completely an answerable way to put that puzzle together.
And I will say that's how we got the idea of tectonic plates and the shifting of the continents and along those lines. It came from the same ideas, and also just looking at the picture of the globe and seeing how everything kind of sort of could fit together into one puzzle piece.
Now, with that, there has to come proof that these plates existed, or that something had eventually sunk into the sea, or that these things were here at one time. Now, who is there in this history that's come forward and said, I think I can prove at one time there was this land bridge that the lemurs eventually got to Madagascar from here, or that, better yet, Lemuria existed in the Pacific?
There was a couple of people. So the one who pitched the idea of Lemuria in the first place was this, he was actually a 19th century ornithologist. He was studied birds, but he took it upon himself to study the mammals on Madagascar, and he gave this talk, and then at the very end of the talk he talks about lemurs, and as part of that, he proposed that land bridge, and he, the very last word, very last sentence was let's just call it Lemuria for grins and giggles or whatever. And so, and that name just stuck with everything. Mm-hmm. And so going forward from that, he really influenced a lot of, deep scientific thought in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And so when you have someone like Alfred Wegener, who was really interested in the shape of the continents and how they all kind of drifted in and out. And so he came up with the idea of continental drift theory.
Okay.
And he called it the whole Indian subcontinent smashing into Asia, and which created the Himalayas. He called that the Lemurian compression. And so right then and there, the whole, you can see how Lemuria was right in the center of these big, huge, scientific paradigm shifting events. And there was also, played a huge part in the evolutionary aspect as well, and getting, humans to a point where they're evolving and getting on to moving off of, their paradise around the world as well. And so, you have people Philip Lutley Schlater was the 19th century zoo ornithologist.
Okay.
And Alfred Wegener. So, folks like that are the ones who are really responsible for creating the scientific idea for there being this Lemuria, the scientific Lemuria.
Now, around what time is the continental drift happening in the all this forming, and what age are we at as far as humans go that this is happening?
Yeah, so when I have to look at the book for the exact numbers, but when Madagascar, so how they think it happened was Madagascar kind of peeled off with India, mm-hmm. and then when it crashed into Asia, it kind of, Madagascar slipped off of India and then just slowly drifted down to where it is now, about 100 miles off the coast of Africa. And that happened, you're talking 55 or so million years ago.
Okay.
when that happened.
Okay. So we're pretty young in our existence at that point.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Very, very. Yeah. And like we're not looking like the species that we are today. We're very much like, you know, one of the very first offshoots of the, you know, the human evolutionary chain.
Okay. Okay. It's not like anybody's roaming around in robes and sandals and going, look at that mountain range, anything like that. Yeah, it's not a history of the world moment, a Mel Brooks moment, right?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, not that we know of, at least yet.
So. Although give Mel Brooks time, I'm sure, Justin, there will be something written, I think probably in the new series, right? Probably.
Yeah, there you go.
Who knows?
Season three,
yes. Yeah, that'll take place probably there. So how is it then that as I struggled to wrap my head around Lemuria here, so describe it a little bit for me here. So we've got this, I don't want to call it's not a kingdom because it doesn't seem like anything's being developed here. It's more like this plush land that's sitting here, and we've got wildlife here, and describe a little bit of what it is that we're finding here in Lemuria.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing is like Lemuria very much is a place. It's a blank slate for whoever believes in it. So they can make it whatever they want to. They can put whatever they want to on there. They can put kingdoms, as many kingdoms as they want on there. And they have this really complicated lineage of that goes back, you know, generations and generations, thousands of years. But for the most part, especially when you're talking about the scientific era of Lemuria, it is very much a paradise. They needed a paradise for basically human evolution, for like the right ingredients for human evolution to happen. And Lemuria gave scientists, evolutionists, Darwinists that opportunity. And so really, when you have someone like a German scientist by the name of Ernst Haeckel coming through, and this idea of Lemuria is out there, he's like, that's perfect for, you know, for man's development from, you know, ape to human. And so he based his evolutionary theories on that development happening on Lemuria, because for him, it was out in the middle of the Indian Ocean. The Indian Ocean is a, you know, a beautiful place. The islands in the Indian mm-hmm. Ocean are spectacular. It is a living paradise. And so it provided that right atmosphere for, you know, evolution to happen. And it kind of stayed that way with all of the other iterations of Lemuria. And okay. So even as it shifts out into the Pacific Ocean, you still have a very kind of tropical-y wonderland. Almost every person who like put forth the idea of Lemuria or their version of Lemuria had made comparisons to like the Garden of Eden the Garden of Babylon. And so just this very lush, wonderful place.
Sure. Didn't Haeckel kind of expound a little bit, not just expound on Darwinism, but try to build on Darwinism?
Oh yeah, he was Darwin's like biggest hype man in the 19th century. In fact, I think more people probably read Haeckel's work than they actually read Darwin's work, and more people learned about evolution from Darwin or from Haeckel, just because he wrote a book called The History of Creation, mm-hmm. I believe, and so it was a very a scientific bestseller in the day for. However, whatever that means for the 19th century, but it went through dozens of editions over 30 or 40 years. And so he would keep updating it and updating and updating with the newest and latest like developments in evolutionary thought. And so because of that, I think it became a very popular work. And it's in that book that he puts forth Lemuria as this, evolutionary paradise for, you know, humanity. Also, you have going off of that was in Darwin's like first book, where he put forth the idea of natural selection and all of that. He didn't go into human evolution. Okay. That didn't come to his like next work, The Descent of Man. But in between that period is when Haeckel published the History of Creation. And it wasn't until, but that was originally in German. And so by the time it was published in English, Darwin had released his book. And even Darwin, in like a second edition of Darwin's work, he said, if I had read Haeckel's book, I wouldn't even bother of, you know, writing The Descent of Man, just because, you know, I think he nailed it. Like he hit it out of the park. So,
wow.
So even Darwin was a fan. So he was very much an influential figure. And also because of that too, because he was such a popular scientific mind of the day, he would end up influence or becoming an influence on Madame Blavatsky and helping her kind of her ideas on Lemuria too. So,
and she's an interesting character. We're going to get to her here in the second half of the program because we're going to get to more of the juicier paranormal stuff on the second half here. And
you guys get the boring science stuff right now. So
we're
got to stick around for the good stuff.
We're indoctrinating you in the first part, and then we're in the second half. We're going to give you the juicy stuff. I don't know why I said indoctrinating. That's more of a scientific deal. So with that, we get the scientists that come out that are vehemently saying that Lemuria was there. It's definitely this landmass that existed. It definitely was sitting out there in the Pacific, and it was, I guess, Justin, for lack of a better term, it was this scientific petri dish of all types of species, but better yet, it was an untouched, unfettered example of how man had grown from what we expect was primal man to what we become now, or we think it was until it met its fate. But yet, we couldn't prove it.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially, right? It's mm-hmm. It's all conjecture, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is like the big reason why Lemuria kind of took off. And that's a great, you used a great term, the petri dish, just because it was so available for people who came later, for like the theosophist and those and the those occultists and paranormalists and whatnot. It provided that like just blank slate for them to do just a playground. It can be whatever they wanted to make it for themselves. And they did that too, which is kind of crazy.
Was there any physical evidence for these scientists to say, other than a lemur, to say, you know what, we know that this land existed. Here is a piece of it. We know that it came from here because.
I would say the only evidence that you have is with someone like Eugene Dubois, who was a Dutch naturalist. Mm-hmm. And so he was very much a Haeckel disciple. And so in the late 1880s, 1890s, he wanting to find that proof of human evolution. And so he read the History of Creation and he was like, okay, our best shot of finding this missing link, that's where the term missing link comes from. You need to find, there was very much the idea that there needed to be fossil proof to prove evolution. That's what was missing to like show off all of the Darwinist deniers, to shove it in their face that, you know, evolution is a thing. And so they needed that proof. And so he went out to the Dutch East Indies, onto Java, and went looking for the quote unquote missing link. And he kind of found any, you know, it's the crazy thing is he kind of found it. He found like, what was it? A skull cap, a femur, and some teeth. And from that, he devised that there was this pre-proto man creature. Which he called, I am not going to attempt the scientific name, but it became Homo erectus, what we know now as Homo erectus.
Okay.
And so that's kind of like one of the only proofs that's was kind of put forth historically for there being a Lemuria, or like almost proof of a like the scientific Lemuria.
Okay. With that, we're going to take our break. When we come back, we're going to get into how people took just that wisp of physical reality and started to run with it. Now we're going to get into the supernatural, paranormal, almost the imaginative part of Lemuria, and what was the eventual fate of Lemuria? What do we think happened to Lemuria versus what actually happened to Lemuria? We'll talk about that with our guest, Justin McHenry, after the break. Again, the book is out there right now and available for you. We have a link in the description of this program. The book is Lemuria, A True Story of a Fake Place. And again, get the book while we're out in break. You're listening to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Our guest is Justin McHenry. He is the author-researcher of Lemuria, A True Story of a Fake Place. When we left you, we were talking about the real science behind the real place known as Lemuria, which was the continental plate that contained life, contained wildlife that we know as lemurs, and how they actually got to Madagascar. We were talking about a land shelf. We were talking about an actual, well, let's call it what it is, Justin, an actual land that contained wildlife, potentially human life. We don't know in what stage of man it was that was there, but we'll take it for what it is. And the hypothesis that scientists had about this land. Now, let's shift gears, because where there is scientific hypothesis, there's of course paranormal stories. they always come in pairs. And they tend to always come in pairs. It's amazing how, to me, it seems like when it comes to science, we want to follow it up with conjecture. We want to follow it up with, okay, but if there's this fact here, well, then we have to imagine what could happen and what could be or what could follow. Why is that, Justin? I want to ask you your opinion on this. Not necessarily what I want to take us out of the book for a second here, and I want your opinion on this. Why is it that human beings need to imagine what the possibilities could be for something, as opposed to take the actual history and be satisfied with the history of something?
Well, I think it leads to just the mundaneness of it all, right? I think it's greater, like you said, the imagination. It's greater to think about the possibilities of what could have been, instead of just saying, you know, I'm in my closet right now recording a podcast. Like, let's talk about like the absolute sexiest thing possible and get to it. I would say I'll relate a story that kind of gets to this point. You know, a friend of mine, I wrote the book, it came out, he contacted me. He didn't know I was writing about Lemuria, and he told me the story about how in the 70s he went and saw a psychic. Mm-hmm. And he asked the psychic, why do I have this deep connection with Stevie Nicks's music? And the psychic goes, well, it's because you and her were married in Lemuria. Like you shared a life together in Lemuria. And it just got me thinking. It was like, well, like, how can you compete against that? Like when you have this, like one life where you're sitting there married to, you know, the great Stevie Nicks. And then you have this life where you're just, you know, who you are in this life. And so it's always greater to be with Stevie Nicks than it is to not be with Stevie Nicks, I guess. That's not really a good analogy.
No,
but it's the best one that I could think of.
It's a perfect analogy because, you know, you've kind of hit it on the head there because, you know, we think to ourselves, what could be greater than what's actually there? Think about this for a second here, Justin. Okay, so we've been talking about this lush tropical land that had this wonderful creature on it, probably had the beginnings of man. We're talking about scientifically the beginnings of life. So the possibilities are endless. You know, you had the beginnings of certain bacteria, the beginnings of certain plant life. Scientifically, it's a playground, right? Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, well, the possibilities are endless.
Yeah.
So it's forgive me for saying this, it's a scientist's orgasm is what it is, right? It's like, wow, it's everything you could ever imagine. Look at this. If you could go back in time and you could drop biologists into Lemuria, they'd have a field day. If you could drop botanists in there, they'd have a field day. If you could drop any scientists in there, they'd have a field day. But you drop the average person into Lemuria, they'd say, well, where's the McDonald's?
You know, you're right.
How are we going to survive? This is really boring. Does my tech work here? Do I get a signal? You know, to the average person, it's like, well, where's the aliens? You know, there's not a lot of thrill to the average person if we present it the way we present it. But the minute you say, yeah, but you know what? They lived in caves and they could connect, you know, they could connect with extraterrestrials. Man, now we got a story.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an excitement factor too. And it's also getting back to what you said about the scientists being excited about what it could be. That excitement extended on to people like Blavatsky and like Rudolf Steiner and like Annie Besant and C.W. Leadbeater. And those people like picked up on that excitement and just ran the ball with it. And also the scientists, the 19th century scientists weren't as maybe disciplined as maybe current scientists are. They don't show that, like current scientists don't really show the excitement there. They're very technical and specialized. You didn't really have that with the people like, you know, Ernst Haeckel or Alfred Russel Wallace, and people maybe writing more generally, but being taken as scientific. And they were like the leading scientific on the leading bleeding edge of science at their time. Mm-hmm. But it was a different kind of era, and so science was just thought about differently back then too.
Let's talk about some of those people you mentioned. Let's talk about Madame Blavatsky. Let's bring her up first. What a colorful character. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, man, she was such a mystery. Okay, so if people don't know, just a thumbnail sketch of her life. She was born in like the Ukraine in the 1840s, I believe. Lived this really, her teenage years really thing. She fell in, or she didn't fall in love, but she married this older gentleman named Blavatsky, and then almost quickly regretted it and like ran away from him. And then she was going to live with her father, because the marriage wasn't working out. And so they sent her on a ship to go, and then she just ran off. And so for the next 20 years of her life, she was just wandering figure that just roving around the world, picking up like occult knowledge throughout the time. And she was supposedly entered into Tibet, one of the only, you know, Westerners to ever go into Tibet. And that's where she learned her secret knowledge from the book of Zazan, mm-hmm. written in a secret language called Zinzar. So she's learning all of this secret knowledge. And then she pops up in New York in the late 1870s or in the mid 1870s and teams up with a guy named Henry Steele Alcott. And they become best of friends, and they form the Theosophical Society. And then so the Theosophical Society explodes. It becomes this kind of like 19th century version of new age thought.
Okay.
And then, yeah, and she just becomes this kind of worldwide known alternative religious figure. And also, like, in that process, she released a couple of books. Isis Unveiled was her first book.
Mm-hmm.
And then her second book, The Secret Doctrine, which is really where she gets deep into the Lemuria lore and just a bunch of other stuff, too. It's really her kind of like manual or her yeah, instructions or guidelines for alternative religious thinking.
She dealt in different things, not just the Eastern religions, but didn't she get into different things like sex magic? She was into the Kabbalah at one time, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was into Kabbalah. I'm not sure about sex magic. Everything I've read about her says she was basically abstained from sex. And that was a key principle of theosophy, if I'm not mistaken. Like, okay. At least for the first couple waves of theosophy, it was okay. Very much there. Not supposed to be sexually active.
Right.
But yeah, she was deep into like Kabbalah, and just like she had a fantastic just knowledge of occult history and all the occultists that came before her. So like Hermeticism and Rosicrucianism and Elpheus Levi and figures like that. And so she had a deep, like she learned it from an early age. Her mom was like actually translating into Russian some of these figures' works, and she would do that to help pay bills while she's roving around the world too. So
how was she getting hold of some of this knowledge? I mean, especially as a female in an age where some of this knowledge is meant only for males.
Exactly. Like it's kind of crazy how she was getting it. Her grandparents, who mostly raised her, had apparently a large occult library that they kept in their house. And so her teen years were like very goth. Okay. And so she would just, I guess, just spend like hours and hours reading those books. And then on her travels, she would pick up even more knowledge going about.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, ahead of her time, that's for sure.
She really was. And like, I consider her probably one of the most, like, she is one of the most influential, maybe 19th century figures, just because what she put forward is still being felt today. Especially if you're talking about like all the woo and new age stuff, it can almost directly be tied back to her, almost like to a T, can be directly tied back to her and what she was doing. She was bringing Eastern religious ideas to the forefront at a time when that wasn't, you know, happening at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's some, you know, cultural appropriation going on there, but she was still making that available to people that hadn't been available before too. So very, very much an influential figure.
Very interesting indeed. Some of the other players that were coming up with some of these theories about Lemuria, you mentioned some others.
Annie Besant and yes. Charles Leadbeater. They were a weird couple. Both also like extremely fascinating individuals, leading like very full lives before they became engulfed in theosophy. They had this thing where they would team up and do like almost, I wouldn't call it astral projections, but they would like do past life regressions, and they would just like shoot their souls back into the past. And so in one of those sessions, they shot their souls all the way back to Lemuria, and they brought back their tale on how man evolved. And so they talk about Lemuria being basically the time of the dinosaurs, like the Cretaceous or Jurassic period or whatnot, because, you know, they're fighting with dinosaurs or alligator, like creatures. That's when you get, they came up with the idea of basically ancient aliens. So these enlightened beings coming down from the moon and Mars in wicker baskets, landing on Earth and basically imbuing us with the knowledge to our primitive selves to evolve into humans. And so that's how human evolution worked for them, was these, you know, moon and Martian based peoples coming down and helping us on.
So Justin, when they say they came down in wicker baskets and helped us, so to speak, are they suggesting that there was some sort of interspecies breeding? In other words, did they advance the species?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what they were saying. And the ones that didn't advance, those are basically what became the quote unquote lower races. And so you get a lot of white supremacist ideas being bandied about in those. And that's because only certain races got to sleep with these heavenly beings.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I don't even know where to go with that.
right?
It's not too far off from what modern day, what we talk about as far as alien-human hybrids and to this day about some of the programs that we think are going on, but we still believe that that happens no matter what race is here on Earth. We believe that all races are being taken and being used in those programs. There's no discrimination in current alien contact. However, but that was formulated by them way back then.
Yep.
Interesting.
So yeah, they were, I found when I was doing the research, and all this was happening on Lemuria, that's what they were, that's what Earth was at the time for Besant and Ledbetter, was basically Lemuria. Mm-hmm. So that's how it ties into the whole Lemuria thing. So when I was doing research for Lemuria, it is surprising how much race plays into it. And because almost in each iteration, Lemuria gets used as a way of either explaining how the white Caucasian Aryan race was formed and how it differentiated from the other races,
mm-hmm.
or it was a way of basically building up a kind of a white supremacist idea for I guess their own, because it's nothing but white people coming up with these ideas. And so it's helping them with their own, I don't know, pitfalls or whatever.
That is crazy. Okay, so earlier you mentioned Mount Shasta.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the theory that there are people or Lemurians living in Mount Shasta. Who comes up with this theory? How is it? Is it channeled from somewhere, or how is it discovered, and who discovers this?
Oh, so it is mostly put forth by a Rosicrucian by the name of Harvey Spencer Lewis. He was writing under the name Wishar Spinlay Survey. So that's just an anagram. You can, switch the letters around and you give up him. So he wrote a book called Lemuria, the Lost Continent of the Pacific, that came out in the 1930s, the early 1930s. And so he was the one that came up with the whole idea of there being Lemurians on and in Mount Shasta. But he was crafting the idea basically from this other man, a guy by the name of Frederick Spencer Oliver, who had written a book. It was published only 5 or 6 years after his death, so he never even actually published it in his lifetime. But in his book, he was receiving channeled information from this Tibetan mystic guy named Philos. And in his book, he talks about this reincarnated man living in California, meeting this Chinese mystic, and this mystical man takes him into Mount Shasta and he beams him onto Venus, and he has this, magical mystery tour, basically.
Okay.
And so that's where the idea really starts, from there being these ascended masters living on or in Mount Shasta. And so it's a very obscure book. It was not really popularized at all. Oliver's book was A Dweller on Two Planets. Mm-hmm. It became a little bit more popular, like more known in the esoteric world nowadays. But at the time, like in the 20s and then in the 30s, it really wasn't. But, you know, Harvey Spencer Lewis took this idea of there being these ascended masters on Mount Shasta and kind of really ran with it. And he put them on Mount Shasta and they've never really gone away. It caused like a mini stir where people started going to Mount Shasta and trying to find the Lemurians for themselves. It got the forestry department in on it because they were the ones who were managing Mount Shasta at the time. And so they had to come out and release statements saying we've been over every inch of Mount Shasta and filmed it from above and all that. And we have not seen one Lemurian sittings on there whatsoever. And it got so bad. So many people were coming there and not finding anything that the organization that he was heading, the Ancient and Mystical Order of the Rosicrucius, had this really, basically they wrote an article saying that because everybody was there, they were messing up the Lemurians' business. So they just packed up and left and went down to Mexico. And so there are no more Lemurians on Mount Shasta.
So they took a vacation.
Exactly. Yeah, they're like, you guys messed up a good thing. And so we're not going to tell you where they are now.
Of course not. No, but wherever they are, they're probably enjoying the sun, the surf, and the sand, and probably having nice tequila shots.
Yeah. So, well, they're very pale, too, so hopefully they're getting a good tan down there.
Yeah, exactly. You had mentioned earlier, too, that with Lemuria, there's of course, we had mentioned before that these aliens had come down and they had not only are they part of a breeding program, but there's also something involving crystals or seeding with crystals. What's going on with this and who came up with this theory?
So, yeah, that's one of the more recent developments in the Lemurian story was it's being used for these crystals. And so that's basically what it's known for nowadays, especially in the New Age world, is to get yourself a nice Lemurian crystal, which you can activate and it'll have certain, properties that will be helpful for you.
Okay.
And so it kind of comes from this multiple combinations. So it's coming from these more radicalized. You can see in each step how Lemuria is getting more and more radicalized or more and more, I guess, out there, mm-hmm. Just outside of reality. But it's also ties into a lot of what Edgar Cayce was doing.
Sure.
And not so much Edgar Cayce himself, but after his death, there was a slew of books being written by people who so the Edgar Cayce Foundation and I forget the name of the Association for Research and Enlightenment, I think that's the organization tied around him, and so they got together and basically indexed all of his readings. And so when they did that, then people started going through and writing these books like Edgar Cayce on Atlantis and Edgar Cayce on whatever. And so there was a book written from people going in and seeing what he had to say about minerals and like the healing properties of minerals and crystals and all that stuff. And so that became a big book and kind of really re-energized this or got people interested in, crystals and minerals and things like that in mm-hmm. the 70s and 80s. And so it really took off this idea of how, you can use crystals for anything, basically. And so that idea was out there. And then, New Age people New Age people in their channelings and stuff like that were like making Lemuria more kind of like a battleground for wokeness almost.
Sure.
And so you have that combination of this this new kind of Lemuria is this place. And then you have this idea of crystals. And so they combine there in Lemuria and they get this kind of alienist configuration of what Lemuria was and how, you know, crystals are involved and being planted here by extraterrestrials for them to come through and use basically as a gas station on their travels throughout the universe.
Well, my understanding of, okay, so when from the different people that I've dealt with and crystal work and whatnot, when you get a crystal or you're getting a crystal from somewhere, it's got to have an origin or a place of origin. So in order to get a Lemurian crystal, I've got to think it's got to originate from Lemuria. But in order to originate from Lemuria, you have to know where it exists. You have to mine it from there. You have to bring it here. And then you of course, you have to have it manufactured. Who's going to Lemuria, Justin, in order to get crystals?
What's funny is, like, so it's the alien in this one, the aliens are the Lemurians.
Okay.
The Lemurians are coming here. They're seeding the ground. What's kind of funny is, like, so most Lemurian crystals today are coming from Brazil, like Brazilian, like, crystal mines. And, like, Brazil mm-hmm. never enters into the Lemurian lore in whatsoever, really.
Okay.
And so it's kind of funny that Lemurian crystals are coming from a place that's not even associated with Lemuria.
I'm confused on that deal.
I still want to find one, though. I have not yet run into a, like, in the wild, a true Lemurian crystal. So hopefully soon I will find one and be the proud owner of a nice Lemurian crystal.
I've never run into one either. Are they valuable? I mean, do they charge a lot for them?
They charge a little bit more than your typical. So a Lemurian crystal is just
it's energized different, right?
Yeah, it's just a quartz crystal. It's just like a phallic quartz crystal, basically.
Okay.
That has the striations running up and down. So it's, There's nothing really special about it other than the idea that it comes from Lemuria.
So with this Lemurian crystal, am I supposed to be able to contact these aliens that at one time had contact with Lemuria? Am I supposed to be able to get a hold of my Lemurian ancestors? Am I supposed to be able to find out if I had a past life in Lemuria? What am I supposed to be able to do with this thing?
I think that the sky's the limit there, Tim. I don't know why you would have to, you know, limit yourself to even that. You can do any and everything you want with a Lemurian crystal. I think mostly it's for, like, spiritual healing and becoming okay. more, more present in the now, maybe, too. So,
yeah.
But you can be more present in the Lemurian now. I don't know why you have to be.
Could I lure a lemur home with it? Because I'd kind of like to have one in my house. I mean,
exactly.
Give it its own room. Maybe, mm-hmm. you know. Is it dangerous to have a lemur in my house, Justin? Probably.
It is. It is only because, especially with ringtail lemurs,
yeah.
they are the only species that have basically a matriarchy. So it is the only one where the males are supposed to be subservient to the females. And so, if you have a female lemur in your house, then, well, you know, better get used to doing all the chores and doing everything for them.
That's too. Pretty much my life, Justin. Nothing would change around here. That's for sure.
Just blessed be you then.
Just saying. So what lessons are we learning from Lemuria as a current society? I mean, is this much like Atlantis? I mean, there was kind of a, for lack of a better term, kind of a moral to the story. What is it we're learning from Lemuria? What should we be learning from Lemuria?
Well, the big thing I learned from doing the book was just, like, how a alternative narrative forms. And so it's really was interesting for me to see how something that went from so being so serious to just going to bonkers so quickly and staying bonkers now. And so just tracking that and seeing how a kind of alternative narrative forms was one of the most interesting aspects for me. And now today, Lemuria is more of a like a just a like a new age spice that gets thrown in with a lot of different things just to give themselves a little bit more street cred.
Okay.
So I think there was the Amy Carlson and the Love Has Won cult that she formed. It was a Max documentary came out about her a couple months ago.
Yep.
So, one of her backstory was she was a Lemurian queen one time in her life. And so it's you see Lemuria popping up now as just sort of that. And also if you go on like 4chan or 8chan or whatever, mm-hmm. or 8kun, you see Lemurian popping up as basically an example of what happens when you have woke culture and it destroys a society. And so that's what happened to Lemuria. It was destroyed by, you know, these woke forces.
Gotta ask you this, Justin. In all reality, when you look at the time frame that Lemuria actually was above water, we'll put it that way, to the point where it disappears off the face of the earth, what's the reality that there was actually a hierarchy, a kingdom, actual governmental systems, or even humans that spoke a language on that piece of property?
I would say zero. like such a place probably never even existed. If it did exist, it was little bits of land poking out of, you know, the area in between, in the Mozambique Channel, in between Madagascar and Africa. Mm-hmm. So, and it happened so way, way, way before there was even, you know, proto-humans. They were so far along the evolutionary chain, it wouldn't even, you know, been considered a human too. So
yeah,
I would say zero to negative zero.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm thinking too. But it's kind of like Lemuria to me is kind of like you remember the aliens from Metropolis? You know how mm-hmm. how everybody had a stylized idea of what an android or a robot looked like in the 20s and 30s.
Then
all of a sudden we came up with a different idea of what an android or a robot looked like. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a stylized idea of what science fiction looked like, or what, you know, we come up with an idea of what outer space should look like, or what science fiction should look like, and then we change our idea. Lemuria kind of has that idea of what, you know, a kingdom should look like, and then it's like a snapshot of time of what the paranormal should look like, or a snapshot of time of what past life regression should look like.
And oh yeah, definitely.
You know what that era thought we should be, or what we aspired to be. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we move, but it's an interesting snapshot, that's for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely it is.
You know,
it's like where Lost Continents go to like let their hair down and get a little crazy. Lemuria is, yeah. And it's fun in that aspect. It's where, you know, like the cool kids, the cool Lost Continents hangout is on Lemuria.
Yeah, you're right about that. Atlantis is very buttoned up. You know, mm-hmm. you know, there's the systems and the technology and government and, you know, everything is very prim and proper. Lemuria is kind of, it's kind of punk.
Yeah, it is. It's like, you know, you have Cyclops there. You have little jelly sack filled beings walking around there from some things. You have moon baskets with like coming down to, you know, party with you. Like, who doesn't want to be there and like have that? You're married to Stevie Nicks apparently too, so like
that's true. You are.
Why can't we all be on Lemuria?
That's right. To find out more about Lemuria and some of the stories that Justin's talking about, again, we only scratched the surface on purpose, because I want you guys to check out this book, and I want you to check out some of the crazy things that some of these researchers thought. I mean, there's some of these paranormal researchers that had some amazing theories about what was actually going on Lemuria. And of course, Justin has some of the 411 about what was going on scientifically on Lemuria as well. It's all in this book, this great book. It's called Lemuria, A True Story of a Fake Place. It's available right now. And we have it right now in the description of this program. You can click on that link. Go get that book right now. Justin, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tim. It was great talking with you.
It was great
for having me on.
Great talking with you as well, my friend. Thank you. Want to thank Justin McHenry for being on the program today. Lemuria, A True Story of a Fake Place, is available right now. And it is in the description of this program. Go ahead and click on that link and get yourself a copy of the book. Again, we just barely scratched the surface today with the information that's in the book. You can find out everything from the science of what Lemuria actually was to some of the more paranormal stories of what Lemuria is or people think it is to some of the more outrageous things that Lemuria is. And I tell you, some of the stories are definitely that, definitely very outrageous. And you're going to want to see some of the lore that is Lemuria as well. Folks, as I was sitting down today to edit today's program, you probably have been hit with the news out of Kansas City about the shooting at the Kansas City Chiefs Championship Parade, the celebrate the Super Bowl win. And by now, as you're listening to this, the tolls are probably up above what I know as of this point when I'm editing, which is that over 20 people are injured, one person has died, and they have three people in custody. Now, I'm not going to make any political statement about this, of course. I'm not going to make any big grandstand about this. I'll just say this. And that is, I think we're getting a little tired of throwing up prayers, although they do work. Prayer does work. And I do encourage you to pray for the people that are still in the hospital right now, and to pray for the family of DJ Lisa Lopez, the poor woman who lost her life in this, who went out to celebrate the Chiefs' victory. That's all it was, to go out and celebrate a Chiefs' victory, to have a little fun on a Wednesday, on a Valentine's Day of all things, a day that's supposed to be about, even though some people think it's just the commercialism of love, a day that's supposed to be about love, and ended up losing her life. For what? That's what we're trying to get answers for right now. There's some curious things about this case, very curious things about this case that I want you to look at in the coming days. At the press conference, which was held just a few hours after the actual event, the police chief of Kansas City came forward and she said the federal government had offered to help immediately. That kind of raised an eyebrow to me, which, I mean, federal government offers to come in and help in major cases like this quite often. But it was the way she put it. I mean, the FBI and the DOJ are mobilized immediately on this, a Super Bowl parade. Immediately. With these three suspects in custody. Now, if this were gang warfare or something that was a little mundane, you wouldn't think the DOJ would be called in, or even, you know, or even the FBI. It would seem like something that local task force could take care of and clean up and could be taken care of quite quickly. So obviously somebody knows something somewhere. The other thing that's quite odd about this case is if you were watching local coverage like I was, and I'm not in Kansas City, but luckily ESPN had local coverage out of Kansas City directly after the shooting had taken place. As they were clearing people out of Union Station about half hour, 45 minutes after the shooting had occurred, and there was nobody left on the streets around Union Station except for emergency personnel, they were putting snipers on the roof of surrounding buildings. Why? There's something very unusual about this. I'll throw that in your conspiracy hat for now. One thing to think about this weekend. The other thing I want you to think about is this. Like I said, I'm a little tired of throwing prayers up every time something like this happens because it's a weekly occurrence now. Here's the thought I leave you before the weekend. It used to be that as a community, we had each other's backs. There was an instance of that today. Thank God there was an instance of that today, because more people could have been hurt, more people could have been killed. If you listen to the reports or believe the reports, there was a group of fans that actually took down one of the shooters. Now, law enforcement officials out there would tell you that's dangerous. Don't do it. If you see somebody with a gun and they're firing into a crowd, the first thing you should do is get away, especially if you're not armed. But somebody saw people in danger and ran to it. They ran to it. Much like the brave men and women of the Kansas City Police Department and their associates did today. Now, I'm not saying you should do that, especially if you're not trained. You're probably going to lose your life. That would be an asinine comment on my part, and I'm not co-signing on vigilantism here. What I'm saying is this: we can all do our own part, and here's what our own part should be. Our own part should be this. Why should it come to people shooting into a crowd at a Super Bowl parade? Seems to me that we can stop this type of evil before it even starts. When was the last time you checked in on a troubled teen on the block? When was the last time you checked in on your own family, maybe troubled members of your own family who look like they're going the wrong direction? When was the last time you took somebody under your own wing? When was the last time you volunteered to be a big brother or big sister? When was the last time you just checked in on someone, period, who looked like they were down and out and having a bad time in life, and just offered to hear them out? There's a lot we can do that we choose not to do. We choose not to be that light in the darkness because it's inconvenient. We need to stop avoiding things because they're inconvenient and start making an effort. The greatest generation made that effort. They went above and beyond, not because they enjoyed it, not because it was a great thing to do, but because it had to get done in order to get through trying times. They recognized that if they didn't do it, it wasn't going to get done for them. Nobody was going to do it for them. We've developed an attitude in our country, and this isn't a political stance, it's a human stance, that somebody else will do it for us. Well, if we don't do it, a machine will do it. Well, if we don't do it, well, somebody else will take the lower paying job and do it for us. Well, I won't do that. Somebody else will do it for me. I can hire somebody to do it for me. I just don't feel like it. That's the wrong attitude, folks. Nothing gets done in life unless we take accountability and responsibility. That's what we're lacking in this country. Accountability and responsibility. It's time for us to clean up our own mess and then look around and see what other messes are lying around and ask, can I help? Can I help you? How can I help? That's how we show we care. And we need to start caring more. We need to start caring more about our neighbors, our friends, our families. We're all in this thing together. As much as we talk on the show about blasting off to another planet and having another place to live, sorry, that ain't coming in our lifetime. You may think we may be able to blast off to another world just 37 light years away and find a Goldilocks zone to live in. It ain't coming. Let's focus on what we have here now. Be a light in someone's darkness now. Want to do something for your buddies here on Darkness Radio besides downloading on a timely basis and listening to these shows or visiting our sponsors? Well, here's what you can do for us this weekend. For the people of Kansas City this weekend, besides sending that energy and praying for them, the victims of the people in that parade who might be struggling for their life right now or trying to heal from a traumatic day, check in on the people around you. Do you see somebody struggling? Volunteer to listen. Volunteer to help. It doesn't take much time or effort. You don't have to change their life. You don't have to overturn the apple cart. Just volunteer to listen. And if it's over your head, turn them over to somebody who can help. That's it. You may be avoiding the next huge catastrophe by helping somebody who may need that essential help. And I'll leave it at that. I'll just add that I love each and every one of you guys, and I really do appreciate you listening to this program. It's been a stressful week, hasn't it, folks? Let's lighten it up this weekend. Have a good weekend. And you know what? We got a great week of shows coming up next week. We'll see you back here next week for the best in paranormal programming. Let's keep Kansas City in your thoughts and prayers and send them some good energy. And we'll see you next week for the best in true crime and paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio.